Welcome, fellow Spellbreakers, to another edition of the Spellbreakers podcast. Gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome a legend back to the podcast, James Corbett. First, I just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor. We have Eric from the Mace. He's a Mace practitioner. His website is on the screen there, macelifecatalyst.com. I've used him personally, really great guy. If you're somebody who's dealing with emotional trauma or baggage, reach out to him. He allows you to let go of that without having to disclose exactly what's going on, and he offers money-back guarantees. So if that's something you're dealing with, please reach out to him. And yeah, now, without further ado, we have the legendary James Corbett, a man who needs no introduction, but we shall give one out of respect. He is a Canadian expat, although we do not hold that against him. Joining us from the sunny climes of Western Japan, he started the Corbett Report in 2007. He is known for his tireless and ongoing contributions to the freedom and truth community. Some of my personal favorite works by Mr. Corbett are Century of Enslavement, The History of the Federal Reserve. I think that's one of the best coverages of the Federal Reserve on the internet. Concise, amazing. His 9/11 series are unparalleled, again, in my opinion. 9/11 War Games, 9/11 Trillions, 9/11 Follow the Money. As well as How Big Oil Conquered the World, Why Big Oil Conquered the World, the follow-up. Who is Bill Gates was a real doozy, and A Brief History of Hopium. He's laid down many of the foundations of the modern truth movement, and I don't think he gives enough cred for that, because he is the OG truther, if you will. So, without further ado, James Corbett, how you doing today?
Well, now I am blushing ear to ear. I don't think I'm the OG truther, but I have been in it 17 years, which is an increasingly long time to be on the internet, isn't it? Anyway, good to be back. Donnie, how are you doing these days?
Really good, man. Yeah, since we last talked, I got married, I bought a farm.
Congratulations.
And I had a baby. So it's been
wow.
It's been crazy, man. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, another one for the good team.
Yeah. Good on you. Trying to, it's funny, all these guys talking about white replacement and stuff. Like, they're not even having kids. They're just complaining online. I'm like, hey, if this is actually an issue for you, like, have some babies, you know. But anyways, maybe we'll get into that. But yeah, what about you? What have you been up to? What have you been focusing on lately? What's going on?
Well, I've been up to my usual production and what have you. But recently, what have I been focusing on? I've been focusing on Peter Thiel. And apropos of... Well, I would say nothing in particular. I guess the connection would be that, of course, as people may or may not know, Peter Thiel is the man who created J.D. Vance, essentially. From the time that he first started out is working for Peter Thiel's venture capital firm, to the time when he ventured out to start his own venture capital firm with Peter Thiel's support, to the time when he ran for Senate with $15 million of Peter Thiel's money, and now... after Peter Thiel affected a rapprochement between J.D. Vance and Donald Trump, now he is the potential vice president of the United States, which puts essentially Peter Thiel one heartbeat away from the presidency. So I think that's worthy of an exploration. Peter Thiel is probably worthy of an exploration, even regardless of that particular set of circumstances. So I'm doing that deep dive right now. I'm two parts into a three-part editorial series on that right now.
All right, so Cliff Notes, what, he's going to save America, obviously, or should we be a little suspicious? What's going on?
No, okay, so really the question at the heart of this series is, who is Peter Thiel? What is Peter Thiel? Because he is branded as a libertarian, and he is self-branded as a libertarian, talks about himself as a libertarian, but oddly enough, for a so-called, supposed libertarian, who, by the way, hates the free market and says that free market's for suckers, monopoly is the way to go. Oh, yeah. He's also someone who has made his entire career out of actively collaborating with the Alphabet Soup agencies to monitor, spy, suppress, otherwise curtail the activities of regular Americans, let alone people around the world. And So I think it's time to actually answer what ideology is really motivating him. And I'm in the process of still writing that part three, where I really get into the deep depths of that. So I won't reveal it all here. But suffice it to say, no, I don't think he's a libertarian. And yes, I do think he's certainly a technocrat. He's a financier with a lot of wealth and power, and he's not using it in your best interests anyway. And I think people should be concerned about that.
Well, I recommend everybody go check that out. But James, come on, let's get into the good news here. We got all of your hard work's paying off, right? We got Trump. He's coming into the White House. He's going to drain the swamp. You know, we got Elon Musk on the case. The dude is pro-human future. I mean, James, come on. Why aren't you happy, buddy? Like, we're literally taking out the deep state. This is historic stuff here. Are you not entertained?
No. Okay. I know you're jesting, and I know that what you're saying there is satirical, but there is actually the kernel of truth to it, which is that, hey, regardless of whether or not Trump and Musk and people like that are on the level or what level they're on, at the very least, isn't it interesting that they have to mount the platitudes about draining the swamp? They have to, like Musk, say, no, I'm pro-humanity. I want humanity to thrive. People should have more kids and things like this. They at least have to give people that, because that is what people actually want. Now, as people know, I know they're not going to do that. I didn't drain the swamp in my first 4 years, but I'm super duper going to do it in this 4 years, guys. Just like I didn't release the JFK records, but I'm super duper doing that as soon as I get in this time. Just vote harder this time, guys, et cetera, et cetera. It's hogwash. It's nonsense. But there is that underlying reality. Yes, they have to at least mouth the platitudes, because they know that is what people want. People don't want to hear the garbage nonsense that has been fed down our throats for generations now about all of the political platitudes and all of that garbage. No, no, no. People want to hear the truth. No, humanity is not a cancer on the earth. We do deserve to thrive and have beautiful, flourishing families without the yoke of government stewarding over us. Yay. So, you know, it is a win, in the same way that I say it's a win that the very fact that the multi-billion dollar propaganda industry that exists right now to try to make you believe all of their globalist lies exists, the fact that that exists is actually a hopeful sign, because it means that the truth is actually a pretty easy sell and they really have to push the lies. So, again, I think it speaks to people, generally speaking, I think, understand and resonate with the types of messages that people like us are putting out there. And it requires, at the very least, they have to pretend to be on our side in order to get people, gullible people, to fall back into the trap that they always fall into every 4 years.
James, are you saying that we can't vote our way out of this? I don't understand. What do you mean? Like, he says he's going to bring it home.
Yeah, you can't, what is it? You can't comply yourself out of tyranny, and you can't vote yourself out of tyranny either.
Yeah, well, let's dig into this. So, like, this concept of the Great Awakening, I feel like Q kind of kicked it off. And now, I mean, I have to be honest, I am seeing a lot of normies really just, like, getting hip to the schemes and scams. Like, I went back to Toronto in the summer, and, you know, I got all these kind of liberal friends who don't really care much. Like, they're now dropping, you know, stuff that would have been in Alex Jones talking points 10 years ago. You're like, you know, they're trying to disrupt the family and, you know, all of this stuff. So there does seem to be this mass awakening occurring, and it seems like they're also trying to steer it. But, you know, what's your take on this? What, you know, is this genuine? What's going on here?
All right. I guess it's how many levels deep do you want to go with this? So let's go to the first level. I mean, one thing that I have said for a long time is that it would be great to actually achieve justice for the events of September 11th. But failing that, at the very least, one thing that we can palpably point to and put our finger on that 9/11, the 9/11 truth movement did achieve, that I think is an achievement and it is worth reflecting, is that certainly, back in 2006, 2007, when I first started getting into 9/11 Truth and then first started the podcast to try to start promoting it, it was still, the concept of false flag terrorism was still a completely foreign concept to the average person. Most people had never even heard of the idea and could not wrap their brains around the concept. Why would the government attack itself was the most common question you would hear if you were to raise the 9/11 inside job possibility. Well, I think that I don't know about you, but I think the general public probably understands that concept at this point. It has been drummed into, oh, okay, I get it. They attack themselves in order to blame the enemy in order to, yeah. They may not believe that with regard to any particular false flag, but I did remark that in the immediate wake of the Boston Marathon bombing, that even Yahoo News had a headline about, was the Boston Marathon bombing a false flag? I mean, spoiler, their article said it was not. But at the very least, the fact that it's now like a mainstream news headline when something like that happens is something along those lines. So in the same way, yes, the whole Great Awakening and all of these ideas getting seeded into the public consciousness is a step in the right direction. And I think there's a couple of ways we can look at it. One is to be completely cynical. Utterly, totally, nihilistically, total cynicism and say that it's all planned, it's all controlled, they want you to understand this and that so that they can make you believe the next lie or whatever it is. I don't go there because honestly, I truly don't think that this is a monolithic conspiracy, and B, I don't think that they have total control over everything that's happening in the universe at all times. If they did, why would I even be here? I'll go off and do my thing because nothing I can say will make any difference. No. I don't think that's the case. But certainly there are pitfalls that we can fall into. Even as the public starts to cotton on to some of these ideas, they can be used against the public. And I would say the whole QAnon sense operation was an example of that. Okay, people are waking up and starting to learn things. So let's start making these Nostradamus-level quatrains that people will be parsing and looking at online, which, oh, by the way, we'll seed in messages about, say, overthrowing the Iranian government or, you know, sit back and enjoy the show. You know, that kind of nonsense to keep people placated with hopium. So using the kind of online cool, hey, you kids like online cool media, alternative media stuff. Well, here's this whole phenomenon that you can devote your life to and wait for JFK Jr. to arrive at Dealey Plaza to unveil himself as the real Q, et cetera, et cetera. All of this nonsense that's happened. So there are definitely pitfalls that people can fall into even as they quote unquote wake up. But still, I don't think that means the entire phenomenon and everything around it is controlled to that extent. I think what this is fundamentally expressive of is the structural change in the flow of information in our society that has happened over the past few decades with the advent of the internet. And that is certainly not to say, well, the World Wide Web anyway. And that is not to say that the World Wide Web is not itself the product of a concerted military intelligence complex operation. I have documented that myself. I did a podcast on Silicon Spies people can look into if they want to know the real history of Silicon Valley and its active collaboration. In fact, its birth really in the bowels of the military-industrial complex. But again, that doesn't mean that they control every aspect of this phenomenon and everything that's going to happen. And it's a bit like saying, I mean, if you were to come out and prove that actually, you know, Gutenberg was being secretly given this technology by the government so that they could then overthrow the church in the Reformation in order to get more power back to the king and take it away from the Pope or some grand conspiracy like this, it still wouldn't change the fact that the Gutenberg press fundamentally changed the course of humanity. And in the same way, the World Wide Web and the access to this technology has fundamentally changed the course of humanity. The paradigm for controlling information and thus controlling society that was predominant in the 20th century, that gathered around these oligopolies that cartelized the mass media industry, that does not work in the 21st century. It has to take, at the very least, different forms in the 21st century and online. And we're starting to see that. And of course, they're going to try to put the cork back in the bottle and control it all and put it back into some sort of oligopolistic context. But that doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to be successful with that. And it does mean that certain things will change in the way that humans understand and process information. And I think one example of that is that people are learning things like false flag terrorism and other associated concepts a lot more quickly than they would have cottoned onto it in the old controlled media paradigm. I don't think that I don't think that's part of the conspiracy plan. I don't think that's something that they're sitting there, ha ha ha, we're in total control of everything. No, I think there are things that we aren't really accomplishing, and that it's up to us really to push that across the finish line and to actually affect some real change out of all of this.
Couldn't have said it better. I totally agree with the sentiment there. You know, that's why I think you have coined the word hopium. Am I fair to say that?
I'm sure I didn't invent it, okay, but I would say that there's been a marked uptick in its usage, okay, since I released my hopium episode.
You're humble, man. I'm going to go on a limb and say you're the hopium, I would say, popularizer in the world. And I'm trying to popularize what I call the post-truther movement. And those are people who, we know what's going on, but then we ask the question, okay, what now? Right. Yeah. As you know, you can go down these endless rabbit holes, and it's doom. I think we get trapped in the doom hopium cycle. Right. And both are very destructive. And so what you put in there is really interesting. And I think, you know, for me, what I've concluded is that I actually think they operate on a razor's edge. Like, this idea that they have total control is a psyop in itself. Right. Because most of this stuff is they don't actually have the power or the influence to even do most of the stuff unless we do it to each other, right? Like, for example, like during COVID in Canada, like, they're basically like, hey, can you oppress yourselves, right? Like, you know, like, we can't send anybody out right now. So, you know, I'd be curious to get your, maybe we can dive into that a little bit more. This the truth movement as it stands now, to me, it just feels like it does trap a lot of people in this either hopium or doom, you know, cycle as well. It really negates our role in the world, that, you know, when we shift consciousness, then it changes, right? And their spells don't really work anymore. But
I'm in total concordance with what you said there, because I think the underlying fact of human civilization is that it is predicated upon enough people, the majority of the people, going along with the consensus narrative and contributing towards the great project of society. And in back in the days, that would have been the, you know, the building of the pyramids or whatever, you know, think of the grand things that kings, queens, pharaohs, emperors directed, and that people went along with, because if they didn't, they would die. And that was the sort of slavery context of manipulation of society that existed thousands of years ago. And that obviously can be effective for a certain amount of time, but I think we understand that human nature is such that those types of top-down, totalitarian controls over society don't last. That there will always be revolution, upheaval. If you put yourself in that position, I am the God Emperor on Earth and I have all the power, there will be a million people that want to kill you and take that power. So it is not an inherently stable way of controlling society. So we saw basically reboots of the Matrix, reiterations of this concept of top-down control. And how can we change it and adjust it so people will be more likely to go along with it? So we get the medieval concept of the wheel of fortune and the feudal system, and everybody has their role in life and all of these types of things that assign people a station in life. And because it's the way you grew up, it's the way your parents grew up, it's the way your children will grow up, this is just the way it is. People go along with that for hundreds of years until technological progress, again, primarily starts to break down that feudal order, and you start to get this trading class that starts to rise, and you get the advent of capitalism, and that changes the societal relations, and suddenly there's a lot more mobility, and people aren't assigned to certain stations in life that they can never leave. So how do you control that society? Well, okay, now we're going to have, we're going to overthrow the kings and queens, and now we're going to have democracy, and you're going to elect your representatives to represent you. Yay. Okay, great. Now, of course, we know how that game is played and how representatives are bought and sold. And to the extent that they have any power whatsoever, they are powers that are beholden to special interests, et cetera, et cetera. We know how that system has become corrupted. So what's the next iteration after this? I don't know. I mean, is democracy the pinnacle of human control over society? And once we wake up to that, game that is a game, then will we be able to actually overthrow the oligopoly itself? Well, remains to be seen. Anyway, I would say that's the sort of the way that that power is operating. And when we put it in that context, yes, again, the fundamental point is that it always requires the cooperation, or at least the consent, or at least the I'll go along to get along of the majority of the population. And when people start to withdraw that and realize that they actually know the power, the wealth that's generated in our economy comes from us and our work and our time and our labor and our interest and our resources being dedicated to these projects, hey, maybe we can build something for ourselves. Maybe we don't need that system. Maybe we don't even need to use their currency. Maybe we can think of completely different ways of interacting and transacting with each other on a one-to-one basis, peer-to-peer. The entire concept of peer-to-peer is, again, antithetical to those systems of top-down control and has completely disrupted certain narratives. So that's, I think, what this is about. And to the extent that they can keep people in that paradigm, it's doom because we control everything, or it's hopium because don't worry, guys, you can vote for this political candidate. They win. They win that game. It's only if we can take the power out and put it to use for ourselves and our own purposes that we can possibly win this.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And geez, I need your help, because like when I started this truther movement back when I was 12, you know, watching AJ, you know, I thought the UN was going to invade at any moment and everything's going to pop off. You know, luckily I was buying gold at like 12. I want to thank Alex Jones for that one. But, you know, now I find myself like kind of like Dr. Strangelove. Like I'm starting to love the bomb. And what I mean by that is, like, I don't try to push awakening or truth on anybody, because I think most people aren't ready for it. And when I look at most people, you know, they just want to go about their day. They want to live their life. They want to watch Netflix. You know, they want to go to the grocery store. And, you know, although I think, like, ethically, a libertarian-style government is more like ethical, like the non-aggression principle, I think ultimately the controllers are just giving people what they want. Like there is a component of mass manipulation and mass psychosis and what we call, you know, spelling and mind control. But at the same time, I honestly just think they're giving people what they want. Like people don't want to grow their own food. People don't even want to really help their neighbors. People don't really want to know the truth. And so it's like, let's just give them bread and circuses. Let's, you know, and I kind of think more and more, it's almost a fair system, you know, and I think if we hit a critical mass of people just saying, all right, you know, time to actually get into adulthood, this would be over overnight. But for now, I just, that's kind of how I'm starting to see the system, less adversarial, more like, this is what you told us you want, and this is what you get.
Yeah, no. I get what you mean. People, the old saying is people get the government they deserve. Yeah. Maybe they get the government they want. And yeah, I think you're right to a certain extent. Now, firstly, I would say I am not actually even sitting in judgment of people who just want to live their life and stream Netflix and drink beer and whatever. Yeah. Okay, great. In an ideal universe, I agree. I think whatever, do what you want. Do whatever. I'm not sitting here saying everybody has to be involved in politics and actively doing this all the time. In fact, I would like to live in a world where we don't have to be actively involved in this all the time, because there isn't some psychopathic class that's trying to rule over us. Unfortunately, I think that is the case. So it does fall on each generation to pick up that cross and keep going and to find ways to fight against it. Having said that, yes. So, societally speaking, okay, unfortunately, yes, we are in this position where the majority of people are not going to be growing their own food or starting, you know, community gardens or whatever it is, or participating in alternative currency. But I think that speaks to the fact that it has been drilled out of us. I think the fact that entrepreneur is a dirty word, even in online alternative spaces. It's still kind of like this, oh, he's trying to create, somebody's trying to sell something to me. Oh, you know, what's he in it for? No. Still, people are in that mindset. No, the answer is to get a government that will provide things for me, not to what you want a free market of people like starting businesses and doing things. But if you read, for example, Samuel E. Konkin III, and read about his, for example, his agorist primer, you will know that the actual vision for the overthrow of the governments and the achievement of a voluntary society is not some revolution. Yeah. It's not. It doesn't have anything to do with voting. It doesn't have anything to do with any political process. It isn't even about armed confrontation or anything like that. It is about the building, the gradual building of communities that can start providing more and more of these services that are offered by government, providing them for ourselves. And as those communities start to get broader and are able to provide more services and able to provide them in a more efficient way, obviously, than the state can,
of course,
people will gravitate to them. And it's that process of gravitation that eventually creates the tidal wave going in the other direction of people leaving the statist society and entering voluntarist society. And I think that's really my vision of it. Yeah, if we don't provide something of value that people want and actually make lives better and easier for them, then why would they leave this system? I mean, yeah, whatever, GMOs, we're all getting fat and lazy, and they're going to put brain chips in us and enslave us, and our children will basically be their slaves. But whatever, that's tomorrow. I mean, today, I want my burgers and beer or whatever. So, yeah, we have to be there to provide people with things that they want or need and do it in a more efficient way than the state, and we win. That's it. All we need to do is be better than the state, and we will win.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I just want to preface it because I'm getting some hate in the comments. Like, guys, they're still psychopaths running things. Like, don't get me wrong, they're total psychos. Like, I think they've been intentionally traumatized into these positions and set up to be what they are, these rulers, you know. But like, psychopaths actually form, like, they have a certain function. Like, they haven't been bred out of humanity for the reason that, like, somebody's got to make the decisions, and us, we're not stepping up. Like, I think it's a call to for us to step up, and if you don't, like, yeah, they're gonna give you the brain chips. But I'm not even worried about the brain chips, James, because we got Elon Musk on the case, and they're based chips, right? So is he not chipping me for freedom? Or, you know, like, should I take the chip because it's him? You know, what's going on with brother Elon here?
Yeah, he's making the good brain chips. He's making the good AI. He's making the good robots. He's doing the Tesla electronic cars for the good reasons. He's signing the Starlink DoD contracts for pure-hearted reasons, no doubt. If people want the deep dive on Musk, they can go to Corber. I'm pretty sure it's corberreport.com/Musk. Anyway, type Musk into my search bar and you'll find several things I've done on him over the years, most notably a podcast episode on Meet Elon Musk, Technocratic Huckster. Long story short, I don't trust Elon Musk as far as I could throw him. And I think for whatever, well, this is the thing. Even if we frame it in terms of, well, you know, Musk has given us so much with regards to this technology or whatever, Musk has done nothing. Come on, guys. Like, let's be realistic. Musk is a huckster, and he sells the sizzle, and he lets other people maybe make the steak behind the scenes. So really, he's responsible for exactly 0% of anything that his companies produce, except for the government contracts, which have always made them possible. However, it should be noted that he literally has a family background in actual, real-deal technocracy. Like, this isn't some kind of, like, oh, he's a technocrat in a general sense. No, literally his grandfather was a member of the Technocratic Party in Saskatchewan, of all places, before the family fled to South Africa, and that's where he comes from, right? Anyway, there's a story there. I've documented it in the past. People can look into it. But no, literally, Elon Musk is a technocrat and is literally seeking to engineer society in a certain way. So let's just put it this way. I'm not telling other people what to do, but I'm not taking the Musk brain chip myself.
I don't know. I just didn't know you were so regressive. You know, like, he's there draining the swap. Like, he just launched that rocket on that little place. Like, dude, if you can't take the chip after that, like, James, I don't know. I think you're a Luddite, buddy. Let's
You know me.
No, I totally agree. I hope everybody could understand that we're joking around here. But I don't think everybody gets humor. So, I encourage everybody to check out your work on Elon Musk. I think it's very, very informative. But I see this as part of like a... Like, are you optimistic? I still am optimistic. Like, back to this concept of the Great Reset. Like for example, their spells and their schemes, right? Like, JFK was, like, 30 years before people were starting to, like, really change the consciousness, right? 9/11 was probably, like, a decade, 15 years before there was, like, a zeitgeist around it. You know what I mean? You know, the Kufid was, like... By year two, most people were like, all right, this is starting to get fishy. You know, the war in Ukraine was like less than a year. Even the diehards were like, this is sketch. You know, Israel, Palestine was like 3 months. Like, I feel like there's these diminishing returns where even your everyday people are just done. Like, it's almost like a dog when you usher like 20 different commands, they just sit down. You know, I feel like people are just done with it. And for me, I think apathy in that regard is actually optimistic. So, but I'm curious, you know, your take on that. Are you seeing what I'm seeing? You know, what do you think?
When you phrase it in that way with those examples, for sure. I think there is a demonstrable, as I would say, I think it's part of that effect that I was talking about with regards to the structural changes that have taken place in the dissemination of information that have led the population to cotton onto things a lot quicker than they used to, and in ways that are less structured and less gatekept than they used to be. So yes, I think that is a narrative that you absolutely can construct. And I would like to believe that that's the case. The reason that I always said that for 9/11 Truth, perhaps maybe its greatest achievement would simply be planting that idea of false flag terrorism in the public consciousness, is because once the public is aware of that technique, then it's a lot harder to actually use it successfully. I think a 9/11 today would have a very different effect and would be treated politically and militarily and everything else quite a bit differently than it was back in 2001. And that, I think, is generally speaking to the good. Unfortunately, now by that calculus, one way that the would-be rulers of humanity can take that is, oh, okay, we need to up the ante. I mean, it has to be bigger and bigger and bigger and more spectacular every time to get people on board. So who knows what kind of craziness, some kind of EMP event that wipes out the grid for a year or two, or nuclear Armageddon, or whatever it is. I wouldn't put it past the types of people who exist in the upper echelons of power right now to at least attempt it if... And when they come to the calculation that it is better for them to do that than to completely lose control of the situation. And don't take my word for it. Take Zbigniew Brzezinski. People might remember back in 2008-09, he went on this circuit of lectures and interviews and editorials that he was writing about the global political awakening that he noted was happening, and talking, for example, about information on the internet is enabling people to speak to each other and awake, essentially creating this global political awakening. People are switched on and more politically active in general than they ever have been in the history of humanity. And he said that one of the ultimate endpoints of that is, well, it used to be a lot easier to control a million people than to kill a million people. Mm-hmm. But now it's a lot easier to kill a million people than to control a million people. And so what do you make of that calculation? And I think at the point at which they say, hey, let's kill a billion people so that we can control the remaining people, is probably the point at which that will happen if they get away with it. And that's unfortunately the escalation that we're talking about to counteract the fact that people are catching on to things a lot more quickly.
Yeah. But I've heard this, I wonder if are they really going to go for the Depop? Like, I thought the jabs, I thought that was the big one, you know, and obviously a lot of people got messed up. You know, I'm on YouTube here, so I don't want to get to too many specifics, but we all know what's going on, right? We know, I don't know anybody who got passed on due to the coof. And every person I've asked, like, hey, do you know a single person who has passed on from the deadly spike? And they say no. But then I ask, you know, I think everybody knows somebody who's gotten injured by the jib jabs. But it's also hasn't been like the, you know, world ender that a lot of the truthers have. You know, they you know, both sides have said it's going to be the winter of doom and all of that. And so I don't know. What do you make of that? Like, do you think they are really going for the mass depop, as they say? Do you think the jab was just training? Do you think it's just too early for it to be turned on?
Yes.
You know, I'd be curious your stake, because like I don't see it as really, really harmful, but I also don't see it as like the big one yet. You know what I mean?
Oh, right. Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, I get it. I would say most conservatively, I would say that the Depop is always in the cards and is always a card that could be played if and when it serves their purposes. More forcefully, I would say, yes, that there are absolutely members of the oligarchy that truly do want the Depop. And I have talked about that before. In fact, I had an editorial earlier this year on the globalists in their own words, just quoting quote after quote after quote from all of these globalists about how billions of people will have to get unalive one way or another, right? As the kids would say, to avoid the censors on the social media platforms. Yeah. So, but yes, clearly, I think the, oh my God, these jabs are the Depop event and it's all going to happen in a couple years crowd have been proven wrong.
Yeah.
But that, let's put it this way. I think what we lived through for the past few years was all about the precedent establishing and the change in institutional infrastructure that has set the groundwork for ultimately the end of humanity in a specific context. And let me clarify that. So, for example, I will continue to cite, because I think it is relevant, October 2019, not only was the time that we had, of course, Event 201, talking about what if there was this globally spreading coronavirus, where, of course, Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation and sponsored, along with John Hopkins, this simulation that involved the CIA and various heads of state and the head of the Chinese CDC, etc. People know about Event 201 by now, right? Surely. But do they know still? I think a lot of people don't know about the Milken Institute holding a conference on the universal flu vaccine that they held in October 2019 that brought together some of the high-ranking officials, at least in the U.S. Medical government complex, including Anthony Fauci and the then head of, I want to say then head of DARPA, at any rate, some high-ranking people in that whole health government space, who were talking about the problem of creating a universal flu vaccine. Because, of course, you know, we have this flu vaccine every year and we have to guess. And we have to guess because we have to culture these vaccines and eggs. And it's this process that'll take months. And so whatever, it's always a crapshoot and blah, blah, blah. If only we had a way to engineer some sort of jab that we could tailor instantly and would work universally. Well, actually, there are some technologies that are in sight that we could probably do this. People are working on these crazy ideas about DNA vaccines and mRNA vaccines, et cetera, et cetera. But they say in that conversation, well, the problem is to get one of these vaccines tested and then get it to market is going to be at least a decade-long process and is going to cost billions of dollars. No pharmaceutical manufacturer is going to want to put out that amount of expenditure to bring something to market that might not even get approved anyway. And then does the public even want it? And they muse in that conversation about, well, you know, barring some sort of cataclysmic event, some new big pandemic that makes people rush towards this, and in which the government can step in to basically get around all of those decade-long safety studies and all of that. Barring that, I don't see how this is going to work. And then literally a few months later, oh, hey, what a coinkydink. So that, I think, is the framework for what we've experienced, is the opening of the floodgate to this completely new technology, this new medical intervention that is not a vaccine. They can call it a vaccine. They can change the dictionary definition of vaccine, but this is genetic manipulation. This is changing the face of what medical intervention is, gene therapy itself, and the introduction of it to the general public and the normalization of it all in one fell swoop, to the point where now we're even beyond the mRNA vaccines. We're now into sa-mRNA vaccines, the replicon self-amplifying mRNA vaccines that have just been unleashed on the Japanese population. Japan now the first and so far the only country in the world to approve the self-amplifying mRNA vaccines for use on their population. The floodgates have definitely truly been opened. And now this concept of the 100-day vaccine is now closer to fruition than ever. The idea that whatever comes up, they'll be able to engineer something and get it and basically get the code and then send that out to places all around the world, and they'll have something in your arm within a few months, which would have been unthinkable pre-2020, is now thinkable. Mission accomplished. And as we talked about, I think, in our last conversation, another important part of what we've lived through is the establishment of the digital ID infrastructure, the very concept that in order to access a public space, you got to scan your QR code, is now embedded deep down in people's psyches. And people have done it before. They'll do it again. So I think it was a very important event. I don't think that was the Depop event. But it certainly sets the infrastructure for any sort of control event in the future that they want to spring on the public.
Yeah. I think that's really well said. And I don't think it's like a one and done scenario, just going to the grocery store, you look at the ingredients, you look at all the, most of the medicines, even the clothing we wear, it's like everything is killing you. So it almost is I think a large part of that is just...
Let's put it this way. Oh, sorry. I forgot to tie the bow on that, because I did say that I think that this is preparatory to the end of humanity, but in a specific sense. That doesn't necessarily mean a depopulation kill shot that kills everyone who takes it. In fact, that would probably be a little bit too obvious, and people might start to cotton on after the first million or 10 million or 100 million people die, maybe, right? So that probably wouldn't be the most efficient way to do it. But no, I'm talking about the end of humanity in terms of what it means to be human.
Yeah.
And to the extent that we start literally tampering with people's genomes and or inserting nanobots or whatever craziness is coming, which again will be normalized, and that's what vaccine has always been. Come on, Winston, get with the program. Whatever they say to normalize that in the minds of the public, that is the end of humanity and the stepping into whatever comes next after Homo sapiens, whatever kind of monstrosity, which unfortunately I think would be controlled at the most basic level. And that's kind of the way that I'm thinking. It's not necessarily a depopulation event in terms of let's kill a billion people, although, as I say, that's always on the table. But it can be, let's literally change what it means to be human. Oh, and by the way, sperm rates have been plummeting, absolutely plummeting for the past half century, and all of these other things that have basically made reproduction harder and harder, to the point where, hey, maybe one day you'll need some sort of special jab in order to have children. And hey, maybe that'll be regulated by the government. Hey, we'll give you the jab if you're, we've got to make sure that you're a good citizen and you know, let's check your social media feed, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, things that sounded absolute fantasy even a couple of decades ago. Well, I could see how that could happen now.
Yeah. No, thanks for that clarification. And honestly, I see this forkening happening, right? I just had my first, hopefully of many, children, as I was saying offline. And, back in Toronto, where I came from, it's like a children of men type scenario. We're like the only people in our social circle having babies, right? It's like this weird, we're the only...
Can I ask, roughly speaking, how old you are?
34.
At a time at which most people in our parents' generation would have been finishing having children.
Yeah, I'm late to the party, but I decided
stuff. Yeah, I get it.
But yeah, right? Like, it's like a children of men scenario. But then when I'm out here, I'm, in the sunny valleys of Alberta, Everybody out here is having kids. Everybody knows what's going on. All our neighbors are like growing their own food. They're, you know, they're amazing people who just know at like a gut level that, you know, these guys are all psychos. And so I just see this like split happening in society and humanity, like people who are pro-human, who want kids, who are just like self-sufficient. And then, you know, I really think that, again, back to this concept of like, they're giving us what we want. Like, you know, none of these farmers have really been harassed. You know, there's endless bad stuff happening in the Canadian government. I don't want to pretend like they're, you know, totally free. But what I mean is like, you know, it's not like Soviet style control, right? They kind of do whatever they want on your property, never been bothered physically, right? Whereas these people who want the jabs and the hyper, you know, super RNAs and the bugs and the VRs, they're free to do it too. So like, I just see this forkening of humanity.
You're making me think, I wonder how much of my eventual ideological eventuation with the Corbett Report and the direction I've had, I wonder how much of that was determined by the fact that I am Albertan. Because, yeah, I mean, there is something about that, the Albertan spirit of, you know, screw you, Ontario. Nope, we're going our own way. We don't care what you, we're totally different. Yeah. And to the extent that that is happening, perhaps on a grander level, as, I mean, by nature, those types of independent pockets that exist in various, I mean, the Texas of the North, in Alberta, what have you, they are disconnected and obviously disconnected from establishment centers of power, which has been traditionally where the media organs have been infested, et cetera. So it's not like the average Albertan had, you know, access to Canadian national media, generally speaking. No, you're going to be talking to the people in Toronto or maybe Vancouver. But now that we have literal peer-to-peer connection with people all around the world, these pockets of independent spirits are coming together to, yeah, share their ideas and understanding and knowledge and realize that they're not alone. And that perhaps fastens the forkening that you're talking about. And yeah, I mean, let's not be naive about it. There are a lot of people who are happy with this direction that we're talking about. They would obviously frame it differently than I have, but they'd be largely on board with it. Yeah, I'm taking the brain chip, and yeah, I'll take whatever jab they give me. It's all good. Maybe that is the answer. I mean, certainly I'm not the dictator of the world, and even if I was, what would I do? I couldn't imagine at some point I'm going to tell people, no, you can't do that. No, you can't develop this technology. I mean, how are you going to stop people from doing that, even if you wanted to? So is it a forkening? And will there be original substrate human beings, purebloods, who haven't taken all of the upgrades? And what will that look like? Will it be an Eloy and Morlock time machine kind of scenario where there will be the, as BBC put it, and I keep going back to this article because I still remember when I first read this article, like 2 decades ago, the BBC had this article talking about the genetic upgrades and things that are coming. And they talked about how humanity was literally going to diverge and there was going to be the sort of the upgraded elite ruling class. And then there's going to be a bunch of essentially unupgraded worker class. And they illustrated that in the article with this ridiculous illustration of this tall, 7 foot, you know, massively ripped, amazing looking human being in this, as they said, squat goblin like creature. And that's the way humanity is going to be. This was on the BBC like a couple decades ago. Anyway, I always remember that. Is that, I mean, I think that's probably their vision for the way this forkening is going to play out.
Yeah.
I actually imagine it might be somewhat, if not exactly the opposite, at least something more like the opposite, as people who don't take all of the jabs and the upgrades and the brain chips and who eat more organic foods and things like this actually live and flourish as healthy human beings. And the people who are hijacking their body cells to create these protein monstrosities and putting in the nanobots and the brain chips and all of that become the squat goblin like creatures that are dependent on their daily big pharma inputs. So Then maybe that's my vision for the future.
Yeah, well said. I mean, who knows how it's going to shake out? But what's the vibe like in Japan? Like I know they're more technological, but there seems to be like a general more trust in the government. Like, you know, like it seems like less extremes, but a higher baseline of just control.
I wouldn't say it's more trust in government. In fact, as evidenced by the fact that, have you been following the big election, all the big election news? Oh my God, the LDP don't have a ruling majority for the first time in a couple decades. Wow, it's amazing. So, yeah, there's a lot of reasons for that and particular political scandals, but yeah, I don't think I don't get the sense that people just trust government here or love government. In fact, government can be the whipping boy, but that's not where, as we know, and as I think a lot of the Japanese public know, that's not where power really emanates from, at least not the sort of the faces that they plaster on TV. Power operates in a lot of collusion and wink and nods between the major corporations and the gang, the mob and government workers, etc., that, you know, and cults like the Moonies, whatever they call themselves these days. That was a huge scandal that erupted in the wake of the Abe assassination, etc. So people are more realistic about that. But that's because Japanese power is not, I think, manifested in top-down control. I think it's horizontal control, or at least more horizontal, insofar as people take orders certainly from their boss at their corporation where you work. If your boss mandates everyone get the jab, everyone's going to get the jab. Yeah. And no one would even think to question it, let alone try. So that's how power operates in Japanese society. And that, I mean, it has, I guess, its benefits and its drawbacks. One benefit for me, being self-employed and not having a boss, I can do what I want, essentially. I mean, there was no lockdown here. There was no mask order. There was none of that. It was all compliance because people just wanted to keep their jobs. So,
yeah, like I feel like it's in Japan, it's higher compliance and social cohesion, but it's, you're not going to get like the America style, like dude's going to pull a 357 on you for not wearing a mask or something, you know, which, yeah, like that's how I kind of, you know, a lot of people are all telling me, dude, you got to go to America, land of the free. Like, for me in Canada, like, don't get me wrong, I see the arguments for why United States is better, but I just think out of sheer, like, lack of capacity to physically oppress you, Canada wins. Like, the landmass and the lack of, you know, when you go to America, like, dude, they will, you know, if there's going to be, like, a martial law scenario, like, America will do it. You know what I mean? Whereas in Canada, like, I just don't think they can actually even do it. You know, what do you make of that in terms of just like generally, you know, if something were to go bad, do you think America, like for me, I think America is going to be the worst place, but then others think it's no, that's, you need to flock there for freedom. So what do you think?
I don't think human freedom is predicated on geography. I think there are, as I say, maybe even certain biographical details in my own biography of growing up in Alberta that have influenced me along the development of my ideology. But I don't think that fundamentally, I mean, yes, there will be areas of relative greater or lesser freedom, et cetera. And I've heard many iterations of the various sort of the theories that people come up with and regale me with over the years, including the idea that, well, don't worry, all this technocratic digital ID stuff, just move to the third world, developing world. They don't have the technology for it. They don't have the infrastructure for it. It's not going to work. But then I've heard people who moved to places like that they thought was going to be freer, down in South America or what have you, that ended up being, oh my God, it was a much, much more brutal police state, fascist sort of military lockdown of the population in the supposed land of the free. So the longer, the bigger term view of things, really, from my perspective, is this is a global agenda. I really do think that this is a global agenda. And the long term, and I don't know, yes, in your particular life, in your particular circumstances, I'm certainly not telling people what to do or not do. Maybe there is some place you can go that will be better for you in this time, and I'm not going to judge people for doing that. But if we're thinking sort of the big picture of humanity, that's not going to ultimately help. If everyone who is concerned about freedom moves every time their freedom is threatened, I don't think that creates the type of resistance that's going to be necessary to actually make freedom win. Having said that, again, I'm not here to tell people what to do or not do. All I know is I'm here in Japan. I got family. I got a home. I've got roots here now. I'm sticking here. And we'll see what comes of that.
Yeah, I think that's really well said, right? Like, you gotta find your niche. You gotta carve out your little niche wherever you are, you know. And it's anywhere, right? Like, for me, I live not too far from two major cities. I can do whatever I want on my property, like literally anything. My neighbors are amazing. Everyone growing food. I'm like, you know, where I have these Mexico bros getting in my face, like Donnie, you don't get it. Like, this is land of the free down here. Like, you're frog in the boiling pot, you don't even know it. And I like Mexico, but then, like, you know, like the same guy who was in my face about it, like friend of a friend, you know, like there was like a massacre like 10 minutes from his house, you know, where drug lords, and then they make fun of me. They're like, I'm like, bro, I'm looking at these stats, there's like 50,000 like deaths, murders a year. They're like, oh, but that's only other cartel people. I'm like, yeah, I'm sure, you know. So, like, you know, this idea that Mexico is like the pinnacle of freedom and safety, you know, maybe it is. I think
if it works for you, great. Yeah. But it's not for everyone, and I don't think everyone has to move to some place in order for freedom to happen.
I think that's a great point. I want to get your takes on Israel. So. I know you've covered Israel a lot in the past. Lately, you've probably noticed this being on the planet, that everybody is like, there's this explosion of blaming Israel and the Jays for like everything, you know. And I think they make some, there's a lot of good points and evidence here too, that, like, you know, Israel or people within Israel have their fingers in a lot of the schemes and pies. You know, there's this like this mass awakening that also to me feels like a psyop, because now they're like, it's getting like almost so extreme that it might be begging for some type of intervention, because like there's like blatant calls for violence and stuff, which is never cool. But I want to just kind of get your take on this topic, because it seems to be exploding in popularity and everybody's now getting hip to the lies and the schemes. And yeah, what's Corbett's take on the Israel Q?
Yeah, well, okay. I mean, do you have 15 hours? No, clearly, Israel, just looking at it objectively, we can say Israel punches above its weight geopolitically. And why is that? You know, why is this small nation that didn't even exist a century ago, why is it suddenly an incredibly important player, not just in the Middle East, but as we have seen through its influence with the Israeli lobby in America, in Britain, in other countries? I don't know if control those governments is quite the right word, but certainly influence those governments. And we could even look at 9/11 and, of course, all of the neocons that were infesting the Bush administration, and some of them literally either Israeli nationals or literally working with the Israeli government, like Douglas Feith and others who were working for Netanyahu back in the 90s, writing his Clean Break document that became essentially a template for the neocons, etc. So, I mean, there's a lot to go through, and Israel with its Unit 8200 and all of its cyber spying and shenanigans and all of that, clearly there's a lot. I mean, yeah, people who point out the crimes of Israel and the things that it is doing on the conspiratorial level, let alone the genocidal level, absolutely, there's, I mean, where there's smoke, there's fire, and there's a lot of fire there. Having said that, I think you're right. The manifestation of the kickback against that, as people start to realize that, can be itself steered and railroaded towards the non-productive solutions of violence and unrest that, as you say, invite, at least in the minds of the average person out there, you saw what was happening, so they had to come in. And back 10 years ago, I was really palpably noticing the pre-World War I parallels that we were living in, with the rise of China against the U.S. hegemon being quite comparable to the rise of Germany against the British hegemon at the time, and all of that, the Thucydides trap that led to World War I. Well, now I think I see more World War II, pre-World War II parallels, one of which is that it was the communist fascist pendulum that created the conditions for what we saw, for example, taking place in Germany, and ultimately enabled what was happening in Russia, which also was then it's being used as a chess piece by a lot of the same powers that were helping to fund the Nazi power party into power. We're helping to, for example, supply the Soviets with a lend-lease, etc. So using both sides of the conflict. Anyway, the point is that the communist fascist melee that was taking place certainly in Germany in the 20s and 30s, or 20s up until the 30s, was the groundwork for everything that came afterward. And I think, and I will demonstrate this in greater detail in the future, hint, 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 I think that was part of a plan that was part of a longer term, not only destroy Germany, but also to use the Soviets, build them up, and to use them as a boogeyman, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we could be seeing similar parallels today, right down to the fact that ultimately it starts to become literally the same things. I mean, isn't it interesting that the sort of the neo-Nazi phenomenon still goes back to the Nazi imagery and iconography and the same stuff? So yes, and then that, oh my God, there's so much to talk about. That also brings in the fact that, of course, Germany and its explicit part in the bringing about of the State of Israel through, of course, the persecution of the Jews, but obviously with Hitler from the 30s onward, talking about ways, for example, well, we need, if we could ship them all off to some sort of Palestinian homeland, wouldn't that be great if we could just ship them all over there? So, I mean, there's a lot to go into with regards to that. But I think now that that World War II touchstone is used as the explicit justification for Israel, the State of Israel, everything it ever does, if you question any part of that or anything that the Israeli state does, then you're one of those Nazis. It's the polarization of society. It creates the two opposed ideas that become the only ideas that you can hew to. I mean, either you're a Nazi or you're a commie. You know, either you are the neo-Nazi contingent, the MAGA or whatever, or you are Black Lives Matter, violent, anti-racist, antifa, whatever they call themselves, right?
Yeah.
What if I'm a normal human being in the middle? Nope. You got to choose your side and you got to pick your team. And yeah, those teams, by the way, are going to fight. And that's what's going to drive the selection process and everything, all the shenanigans that go around that and civil war and all of this kind of stuff swirls around. So, yes, there is definitely a way that the Israel issue can be weaponized and then used for a grander political, geopolitical purpose. Yeah. That doesn't mean that there aren't things to point out that Israel is doing that are wrong. And I'm happy to do that. And I've done that quite a bit this year.
Yeah, it's exactly as you said, you know, like, and it's hard to put it in context for me, right? Because, there's like these dual citizens in all, like, very overrepresented in American politics. You know, if you just look at the jab program, if you look at, all the wars were basically, you know, Project for a New American Century, which you've spoken about at length, were basically just Israel's enemies, right? And the argument is broadly like, these guys are the core evil of the world. Like, you know, they're pulling most of the strings, which I think then, as you said, that feeds back into like making them victims by, you know, kind of promoting that kind of stuff. So, but at the same time, like America, just like you've covered with China, America likes to set up other countries to rise to be like a paper tiger that they can then use for their agenda. So you know, I don't know to what extent it's like Israel that's compromising United States versus United States is actually puppeting Israel. Yeah,
There can be some interplay there, and all of this is complicated by the fact that there's not only Zionism but Christian Zionism and all of the apocalyptic end time kind of stuff that some people really do believe in, and so there's all of that swirling around this issue as well.
Yeah, and yeah, maybe we can end with that. How are you seeing things in the next few years? Like, for me, I see they're really pushing this WW3, and I thought it would be popping off by now, but. Back to our earlier conversations, I actually don't think they're going to be able to pull it off. in the way that they think, because I think people already don't care. And there is this mass movement in America just saying, like, no more war. We're not going to die for you. You know, you know, and I just don't see the political will there. And then on the left, they all hate Israel for decades. So there's not that bipartisan, you know, but you know where they want to go. Well, like,
I'm biased because I'm here in Asia Pacific. So I'm sorry, Indo-Pacific, as the U.S. Military now calls it, because you can't call it Asia Pacific for some reason. Anyway, I'm biased because I'm here. So I really do think the World War III scenario involves China. And I really think, I mean, I don't know if it pops off in Taiwan, but that would certainly be a triggering event, et cetera. And I think that's, there's all the Middle East stuff. There's all the Russia-Ukraine stuff, but I really do think that's peripheral to the China issue, which will be more important in the coming years. And unfortunately, I think whipping people into war hysteria is probably one of the easiest things, knee-jerk war hysteria. It can be done with an inciting incident. And would Pearl Harbor work in the same way today as it did in 1941? I mean, I think it would be exposed a lot more quickly for what it was, but it would still have the effect, I think, of getting people ready for war. And what will the Pearl Harbor of the 21st century for World War III, what could that look like? I don't know, but I'm sure that they can get a lot of people, the average person sitting there, you know, in their home in Wyoming or Alberta or wherever else, really hating Chinese people. I think it could be done. And you know, that's, I wish I was as optimistic as you. No, I still think a World War III possibility, as in actual hot war, is a possibility. And I think that, unfortunately, ticks a lot of the boxes for the would-be controllers, because it fixes the problem of the declining trust in institutions, because in wartime, everyone rallies around the flag. Yeah. It fixes all of the domestic issues around digital ID and whatever. Again, you can round all the Japanese people up and put them in internment camps in California. That's fine, right? Yeah. Because it's wartime. You could do something similar with regards to World War III. It ticks all of the economic boxes because, again, with rationing and whatever other controls come in as a part of wartime, you get to institute new experimental things like a digital currency, etc. Yeah. It solves the sort of the geopolitical issue of how do we install global government, because World War I led to the League of Nations and that attempt. World War II led to the United Nations and that attempt. World War III leads to ... Let's find out. Let's not. I hope you're right. And I hope, and I think unless and until people realize we are being led in this direction and that war is a racket and it is only ever in the interest of the ruling oligarchs and never in the interest of the average person sitting there in their home, unless and until we realize that, take that consciously on board and make that a part of our mindset, then we can be led along into the next war all too easily. We have to reject it before it happens. And that's what I'm here trying to ring the alarm about.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. I just always try to think ahead and like how they can pull it off. Like now I think there's zero appetite for it. You know, even with Israel, you know, when Iran was attacking and Israel was attacking Iran, even people are just like, I'm done with it. You know, so I think they do need that new major event because I don't think the sentiment is there now. What that is, yeah, they probably have a lot of cards up their sleeves. I just see this. I guess I'm bullish on apathy. Like I just see more and more people just don't care and just say, I don't, you know. So it remains to be seen. But I guess, James, with to finish things off here, and anything you want to leave the viewers, thoughts, predictions, solutions. I love your solution watch segment. I always are sharing that kick us off with a
couple solutions. I think we have covered the bases here. I will just say if people are interested in what I have to say or think, CorbettReport.com is just the place to go to find all my work and explore it to your heart's content. It's a resource. It's there to be used. And then share that information either my work directly, or you can just share the information itself and pretend that you came up with it all yourself. I'm totally fine with that.
Just share it. Awesome, guys. Yeah, links are below. Please support James. And I'm going to, guys, just thank James quickly offline, and I'll be back on. So give me one second.